previously on We Live Here.
You know, our area has a rich history of discriminating in housing and using housing as a way to separate and oppress.
Well, I mean, I think it's been a very effective tool for the city to have safe, stable neighborhoods that, you know, that aren't creating problems for people that live here.
If we don't stand up for ourselves, there won't be nobody else to stand up for us.
Hey guys, it's me, Tim.
And me, Camille.
So have you ever had like a milestone in your career that just like seemed to come way ahead of schedule or just at least earlier than you had expected it to?
Totally. I remember this time when I was a much younger person. I was I'd applied to this newspaper that was like Mecca. That was like a dream job. And mm-hmm. I got it way earlier than I ever thought I would.
Yeah, I remember the first time I filed a national story, and like the night before I took it to the editor, I must have read that story like 100 times.
Well, recently we had somebody stop by our studio to tell us the story of a big day in his career that came sooner than expected.
Test. Can you pick me up?
This is Lee Camp. He's a 30-year-old attorney with Arch City Defenders.
It's a nonprofit law firm here in St. Louis that focuses on low-income and homeless clients. In fact, we profiled the founder of Arch City Defenders in Season 2 when he was talking about his work on behalf of municipal court reform.
At any rate, Lee's just trying to get his headphones square. How's that?
Yeah, that's better.
You got it?
And I can hear myself now.
All right, so after we kind of get the audio stuff all figured out, Lee tells us a story of how a little bit more than a year ago, he was in near constant preparation for what would be a huge moment in his young career.
I'd be at home getting ready in the morning and start to record myself and watching the mechanics of myself while I was getting ready and talking parts of this argument.
So you were like videotaping yourself?
Constantly.
In the morning?
I would drive to work recording myself. I locked myself in a conference room at work that had no windows so that I could work in there with no one even knowing I was in there to practice.
The point behind all these mornings recording himself and all this time alone in the conference room at his work and all this advice he was collecting from his colleagues and mentors was to get him ready to deliver oral arguments before the Missouri Supreme Court.
I wasn't intimidated by it because I knew it at that point so well. And I knew it so well because I had so many people helping me and challenging me along the way and making sure that there was no stone left unturned that I could wander off into in this argument.
This was a big moment for Lee because the case he was about to argue has far greater implications.
For years, housing advocates in Missouri and elsewhere have tried to level the playing field between tenants and landlords. And on this particular morning in February of 2017, the push for change fell on Lee's shoulders.
The law does not always work for poor people. And that's historic, and it's definitely, you know, not always worked for people of color. And that's why we're in court, is to argue the law about its impact on a poor person of color.
Today, we tell the story of how a partnership between an idealistic young lawyer and a woman who refused to back down could change tenant rights in Missouri for years to come.
Good morning again, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Lee Camp. I have the privilege of being here today representing the appellant in this matter, Ms. Latosha Johnson, who more importantly...
From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here, a show for people somewhere on the woke spectrum.
Before we get back to Lee Camp's big moment in front of the Missouri Supreme Court, we need to introduce you to the other main character of this story.
Hi, I'm Latosha Johnson.
Latosha recently met up with us on her day off. Any other day, the busy single mom would have been prepping to get to the boring warehouse job she's had for the last 6 months.
You know, it's a job. The work is very easy. It's not, you know, difficult. I think the most difficult part is traveling over there from St. Louis because it takes me almost 2 hours to get over there.
We're on our way to a park in downtown Clayton, Missouri. It's a really wealthy suburb of St. Louis.
And as we walk, Latasha explains her daily routine to us. She doesn't have a car, so she has to rely on buses and trains to get to her warehouse job, which is about 15 miles away in Illinois.
I have the evening shift, so I get off at 3:30 in the morning.
And then you have to take a bus.
Mm-hmm. The bus started up at 3:19, so they allow us to leave at 3 o'clock.
Figuring out how to navigate a fractured region like St. Louis, which has resisted calls to invest in public transportation, is an obstacle for thousands of carless people like Latasha. And it means that place, where you live, is really important.
Which is why, 4 years ago, Latasha was so excited to move back to her old neighborhood of Breckenridge. So Breckenridge is this little teeny tiny municipality in northwest St. Louis County. Latasha liked it because it was in the right school district for her young daughter, who has cerebral palsy.
I could literally, you know, walk to wherever. Again, I had convenience because I'm on public transportation. It was very, very much more convenient for me to walk whichever way I wanted to go on the St. Charles Park Road and go grocery shopping or go to the thrift stores or go wherever. And everything was right there.
Plus, Latasha was also familiar with Hickory Trace Apartments, where she signed a lease for a one-bedroom apartment. Several years ago, she'd rented a unit from them.
First time I never had any problems with staying there.
But that peace and optimism about her new home didn't last long.
The first time something went wrong was actually in November of 2014. And I had let them know that, hey, you know, the floors are starting to, one of the floors are starting to crumble up. And they said, well, you know, that has nothing to do with us. Maybe that already had been there. Or they gave me some type of excuse as the reason why they didn't want to fix it. I said, okay, well, you know, I'm in this thing here, and so I can't, you know, really, you know, do much about it now because it's only a little bit. So, you know, I did what I could and, you know, tried to work around it. The second time, I think I complained about the stove not working, and they came out to fix the stove. The third time, there was water that was leaking.
That winter, Latasha says things got worse. The bathroom leak concerned Latasha, as did the mold she began to see on the walls. In management's fix, caulking around her upstairs neighbor's tub didn't stop the water.
Latasha withheld her rent in March 2015, hoping it would prompt some action. It didn't. And 2 weeks into the month, disaster happened.
And then it became more dripping until one day, the whole ceiling just caved in. Well, half the ceiling just caved in. And I called them at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they didn't show up until 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning to come out and look at it. You know, and I actually called the emergency number, and a guy actually called me back and said, hey, what's the problem? I said, my ceiling just caved in. And he said, well, there's nothing that we can do right now.
Even when management and maintenance officials did arrive to Latasha's apartment, they didn't have an inspiring solution. Instead of fixing the hole, they covered it up.
They put a trash bag over it to stop the water from coming through. But the problem is that the trash bag was so full of water till it stank. It literally was a worm coming out of the freaking wall. I tried to reason with them and say, okay, well, you know what? If you'll allow me to break the lease, if we can break this lease, you pay me back my deposit, I can go about my way, you can go about your way. They didn't want to do it like that. They tried to give me they tried to send me over to a different apartment building, but that apartment building also had molding in too, so it wouldn't make no sense for me moving from one apartment to the other apartment. Then they tried to say, well, you know what? We can try to fix up on it while you're here, and you can just use a different restroom and still stay into your apartment, but go to a different apartment building whenever you need to use the bathroom. Well, that wasn't going to work for me either. So I finally ended up having to just move out. And I became, after standing in hotels on top of hotels, after standing in shelters on top of shelters, and going back to hotels, I finally ended up being homeless on the street. And it wasn't easy.
It also now was a legal matter. Because they hadn't gotten the rent paid that month, Latasha's landlord sued for eviction.
And so that's how I met Lee Camp.
Latasha turned to Legal Services of Eastern Missouri for help. It just so happened that Lee had just landed there, where he was establishing himself as a standout young lawyer and earning a pretty interesting nickname.
Hipster cowboy.
I like it, yeah.
Because he couldn't make up his mind if he wanted to be a hipster or a cowboy.
Jackie Langham is a longtime housing attorney here in St. Louis, and she supervised Lee at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. She stayed his boss when they both moved over to Arch City Defenders.
Lee has a really big personality, and when you have interns that fit into one of two pods, you have an intern that, like, runs away or, you know, just doesn't feel comfortable in the setting because they've never been in that setting, and then there's Lee, who was like, give me more work to do. What can I do now? What can I help you with? Those types of things. And he just stood out as one of our interns.
He was also eager to help Jackie take on an issue she'd been chipping away at for years, standing in the gap for people who can't find affordable housing in St. Louis. Now, at this point, you might be thinking to yourself, wait a second, St. Louis, that's one of the cheapest cities in America to live. Well, for some people, that is true. But the foreclosure crisis, Jackie says, changed that for many, many residents.
She worked on a special program aimed at keeping people in their homes. And the city's aging and sometimes shoddy housing stock just makes things worse.
A lot of times they're not airtight. The electricity could be the bill. The electric bills and the gas bills are astronomical. And a lot of times, you know, the windows are not efficient. And so you may be paying $200 a month for rent, but you're paying $3,000 for a gas bill for the winter. And it just becomes a cycle, and you can't get your gas on unless you get that paid. So on the whole, it may look like it's cheap, and it is cheap when you compare it to big cities. But when you're talking about people who don't have money to pay all of their bills, at some point, something's going to have to give.
The problem became so routine that Jackie and other housing attorneys began thinking of creative ways to challenge this issue of habitability in court. And that's a big lift in a place like Missouri, where landlords generally have the upper hand legally.
Just for example, landlords can have their cases sped up in court, and they usually have more money to hire lawyers to fight those cases for them.
So attorneys like Jackie thought, why don't we try applying consumer protection laws to get more rights for our tenants?
And that idea piqued the interest of Lee, the son of a teacher and landscape architect who grew up just outside of Nashville.
One thing we knew that needed to happen is we needed to teach the judges this consumer path. That's something that Jackie and I had talked about. Like, let's try to shift this a little bit more and show, like, this is a consumer transaction, a real estate transaction, the same way if you were to go buy your home, there's implied things that come with buying a home. Well, there's implied things that come with renting a house, too. And it's a home. I mean, your rental home is your home. There's no difference at all.
But in order to make this case to judges, they needed to find the perfect client. And one day, as they were dividing up cases, Lee grabbed Latasha's folder.
She was due in court within weeks to face eviction.
And I got to meet with Ms. Johnson 1 week before. Talked to her. She brought me pictures. Awful conditions. Ceiling had fallen out of this home in the bathroom. Leaking. There was a trash bag over it. The hole in the ceiling that was above her shower. She was telling me about staying at a hotel to actually give her daughter a shower and a bath, and that she had been applying for places and was having no luck and didn't know what to do. Filed some pleadings and said, this home is uninhabitable and we have some defenses, and actually we're gonna sue you, landlord, for not taking care of this and misrepresenting your real estate relationship with Ms. Johnson.
The St. Louis Circuit Court judge who heard the case didn't buy it. And this is where things get interesting. Because despite the fact that Latasha had documents, pictures, and even an admission from the landlord that the conditions of her apartment weren't her fault, the judge sided with the landlord on technical reasons.
You see, here in Missouri, tenants are told that before you can sue your landlord, you have to give your rent money to the court, and the court holds it kind of like an escrow account. Now, this isn't something that's written in the law. It's common practice. But Jackie and Lee say landlords frequently succeed when they bring up this practice in courts.
And for Latasha, this court defeat was devastating because she was now officially homeless and marked as someone with an eviction.
It was scary. It was horrible. It was, I felt betrayed. Like, I just felt like life almost just went to a spiral end. And I didn't do anything wrong, but asked them to fix up the apartment.
And this is where most eviction stories like this would end. But not this time. Because Lee saw a silver lining in this initial court loss.
This technicality about posting rent in escrow, he believed, had far bigger implications. And he was ready to fight it.
You know, I'd been practicing for a little bit at that time, maybe half a year. So, yeah. And
I thought you were going to say like a year and a half.
Six months. I knew it was an issue to like this kind of quirky area of the law that leaves people with this choice of a rock and a hard place. I knew it was an issue. I'd been talking to them about it. They're like, yeah, the case is so hard to find. To challenge it with, and I was like, I think I got it, guys. Like, I got someone that tried to do everything the right way, except leave her home because she didn't want to make her and her daughter homeless and her daughter have to leave her school district, but instead stayed in hotels with the money she was withholding and tried to go somewhere else.
Lee took this idea to appeal the case to Jackie, his mentor, and they took it to their bosses. The lawyers decided to take a chance and ask a higher court, Missouri Court of Appeals, to take a look at Latasha's case.
And then there was his client, Latasha. And turns out she was ready to fight too, because even though she had lost her home, she had found faith in this young lawyer.
It was a little awkward because I'm like, okay, well, does he really know what he's doing? Because, you know, he's so young. So I'm like, okay, so I'm just gonna just watch. But the time when we had went to court and I listened while in court, and he actually done research and went back and researched history about these different laws, I'm like, wow, this man literally went and done history upon these laws. I'm like, okay. So I kept him around because he actually done research and went.
Lee hadn't even been a lawyer for a year when he picked up Latasha's eviction case. And the pace of events, it seemed, never slowed.
We filed for an appeal probably within 20 to 30 days. It was pretty quick.
Both of us. It was our first appellate case.
5 months later, I can't remember exactly, we were back in a courtroom arguing again. We filed all our briefs and all those things, and we were back doing our first argument.
Then they waited. And in September 2016, they got an answer.
Latasha had won. The judges took issue with the idea that the only way Latasha could legally challenge her landlord was to pay rent into an escrow account, even if that apartment was uninhabitable.
The appeals court also ruled that this was unfair because it would keep a tenant from using that money to find new housing and force them to live in an unsafe and unsanitary condition while pursuing the claim in court.
Their decision was unanimous.
But because they determined that Latasha's case had broad and significant public interest, the appeals judges also simultaneously kicked the case up one more level.
And this is how Lee, just a couple of years out of law school, and Latasha, who refused to accept the status quo, ended up in the Missouri Supreme Court.
Now, we probably asked Lee about 10 different times if he was nervous on that February morning in 2017 when he went before the Missouri Supreme Court. And every time, without fail, he was like, no.
Yeah, and when he describes going up to that podium, you can begin to understand why.
People walk in with boxes and boxes of documents. What I actually took up to the podium to argue was one page. I'd taken 2 years worth of work and two briefs and all of these different policy arguments and was able to get it down to one single page worth of bullet points. When you can look down and see that you're that prepared, I felt good about it.
Overall, Lee's argument is about whether or not Latasha had equal access to justice.
And more specifically, it comes down to something called the implied warranty of habitability.
The implied warranty of habitability is not to be used just to say there's paint chipping in my house, broken blinds, maybe even like a light switch isn't working, different things like that. It's a remedy to be used at the highest level of true structural problems, things that affect your ability to use that home and that do affect your life, health, and safety.
Now this seems reasonable, but Lee says the law is a little murky. So we asked him to take us inside the courtroom that day. And luckily, the whole thing was recorded. So what you're about to hear is tape from Lee's oral arguments before the Supreme Court.
And what he has to say is from prepared statements, and other parts are responses to specific questions from judges. You may hear us and Lee jump in from time to time to give you some context. And he starts by going back to a decision from the Western District Appellate Court in Missouri in a case called King versus Moorhead. It'll come up a few times.
In 1973, that court told us that there is indeed an implied warranty that a landlord will provide a safe and habitable premises in every residential rental lease in Missouri. In that case, the court talked about how we were departing, this was a departure from the harsh remedies of property law, common property law.
Really, truly, the easiest way to describe it was that departure from agrarian law in context with rental leases. The early 20th century, a lot of people, you know, were renting property where they were raising crops, essentially, at the exact same time they were living on this property. And so, you know, it makes some sense. Like, you take a piece of property to raise crops on, well, if it doesn't work, that's a little bit easier to justify in this sort of, you took this land, you chose it, you made this decision versus rental housing in a very modernized society. And so this was a marked shift throughout the United States when the habitability law started to develop to try to level that playing field for landlords and tenants, to give tenants, you know, a way to enforce the contract, to enforce the agreement that a home is not property the same way as a piece of property in agrarian times would be used to raise a crop.
A separate Missouri Supreme Court ruling in 1984 confirmed that a rental lease is indeed a contract, but it also didn't make clear whether a tenant had to put their rent in escrow in order to challenge whether the landlord was holding up their end of the deal to provide a habitable residence. In legalese, this is called dicta.
Dicta is basically something that people do, but they don't necessarily legally have to do it. And Lee says telling Latasha she has to follow this long-standing practice in order to challenge her landlord runs against the core of the contractual agreement with her landlord.
The argument that there is a discussion that money must be set aside in any manner comes from the case of King versus Moorhead. Again, that was the 1973 seminal case that recognized the implied warranty of habitability. And in that case, the court tells us that a tenant's obligation to pay their rent is suspended when the landlord has breached the implied warranty of habitability. In that case, the court also suggests that a tenant who does withhold their rent shall post their rent into the court in custodia legis. That issue of posting your rent into the court, if you remained in possession of a home while there was pending litigation, was not actually before the court at that time. We argue that it is dicta, and we've outlined that argument in our brief as well.
And we actually were able to finally, at the Supreme Court level, get the landlords to concede this was dicta, and dicta itself is not binding precedential law on any courts. It's just an opinion that people argue, and
Our law is developed through people making arguments on on different statements that way. And so the landlord is absolutely trying to advance that position that that dicta should be adopted as law and use Ms. Johnson's case to do that.
But you went back to the source and said, yeah, it's not really in that.
And that's the minutia that you're living in when you get to this level. We had an incredibly detailed policy brief filed by the ACLU of Missouri, by numerous different poverty, national poverty groups that really laid out this argument so that I didn't have to do it in my particular briefing or my argument there, but that we supplied the court with a lot of information to really back up what the Eastern District was saying, that, yeah, landlords might take advantage of a poor person not being able to do what any of us could do today. And that is pay the money and then potentially move, or pay the money and leave their belongings there while they're trying to find a new home, something that was just never in the cards for Ms. Johnson.
When Lee finished, it was time for Randall J. Ranker to present his argument. Ranker is an attorney with Ranker, Hamilton, and Piper LLC and represents Kohner Properties. It's the company that owns Hickory Trace Apartments, where Latasha rented.
Ranker denied our interview request, and he did not give a reason when we asked him why he denied our interview request. But we want to play you some tape of what he had to say in the courtroom that day. And here's part of an exchange regarding the warranty of habitability and the requirement that a tenant pay into an escrow account in order to challenge whether a landlord is holding up their end of the deal.
I think in requiring the escrow rent late, it levels the playing field a little bit, because if the client, if the tenant's going to stay in the property, they shouldn't be able to also hold on to their rent. They ought to either get out or pay the money in escrow. That way, we started it as an even playing field. And I find it interesting that
Is it an even playing field if their argument is that the property is not worth the value that you're saying the rent is, because it's in a defective condition, it's the ceiling's falling in, it's not habitable, therefore the rent is more than the property is worth? And they may be totally wrong, it may absolutely be worth what you say, but why do you have to have something put in escrow up front in case you happen to win?
Because that's for the court to determine, not for the tenant.
Right, absolutely. And until the court determines it, why do they have to pay what would be if you won up front? And tell me why uniquely in this situation, since we don't in any other one I know of require that.
In this particular situation?
In an implied warranty of habitability.
Because in the appellate court's decision on page 17, they indicate, gee, landlord has all of its rights and remedies. They can go and sue for all the money that they're owed. However, in the reply brief of the defendants, they admit their client can't pay it. So there is no remedy for my client in this situation. They can't get the money because there's no way that Ms. Johnson's going to pay it. And I think everyone in this room is going to agree with me that if we're successful in this case, my client's not going to be able to collect the money from Ms. Johnson.
That same judge points out that the lower court awarded Latasha what's called a set-off. And a set-off is basically a quirky kind of thing that courts can do. It's at their discretion. And you can think of a set-off kind of like a refund.
In this case, it was for $300, the amount Latasha had spent on hotel costs.
And that judge says if this happened, isn't the lower court saying that the living conditions of Latasha's apartment violated the implied warranty of habitability?
A little later, Ranker disputes the idea that the living conditions in Latasha's apartment were actually that bad.
I don't think that there was a dangerous unsanitary condition in this case. There was certainly a collapse of the ceiling in the shower. There was a leaky problem. But I think...
Weren't those issues for the trial court to resolve on those factual issues about the severity of the problem, how often she had complained, whether or not there was mold, whether or not it impaired her daughter's ability to use the bathroom during the month's period? And you both presented evidence on either side of that?
We did. And it's interesting because the cases that I've read, when it interprets the implied warranty of habitability, they talk about roaches and vermin and freezing and open wires and missing screens. And this case just doesn't rise to that level.
So you want us to hold as a matter of law that a hole in the ceiling where it fell through from the bathroom above and the mold, as a matter of law, is not a breach of the implied warranty of habitability?
No, we don't.
Okay.
We want the trial court to decide that. And clearly in this case, the trial court didn't think it was that severe a problem to provide a complete bar to my client's ability to collect the rent.
Ranker says his client repeatedly tried to fix the problem, but Latasha would not cooperate, something Lee and Latasha dispute. And there was an emergency maintenance clause in the lease that gave the landlord access to her apartment to make urgent repairs.
My closing thought is economic-based. Because we have a society, if we want to assure an adequate supply of affordable housing, if you increase the barriers to the investors, the managers, the builders, to entering into these apartment complexes to provide affordable housing, you're not gonna increase the supply if you allow the tenants to hold those properties hostage and not pay the rent.
Ranker said ruling in favor of Latasha could exacerbate any housing shortage. Because, he said, if tenants like Latasha can raise challenges without putting rent in escrow, investors won't put their money toward affordable housing. They'll put their money in the stock market or something else.
We've got a link to the complete audio from this trial at our website, welivehere.show.
A few weeks ago, back on a park bench in Clayton, Latasha says the past 3 years have been a roller coaster.
And despite the fact that she's challenged the grounds for her eviction to the highest court in the state, it is still on her record.
I have been turned down numerous times only because I have an eviction on my record. One eviction on my record for an apartment that was not my fault. I had nothing to do with it. It has stopped me from maintaining my apartment, from maintaining a suitable living. You know, I've had jobs, but I just can't seem to get an apartment. So when I'm honest about, you know, hey, I have an eviction, and they ask me, well, why? And I tell them, it's an automatic no. It's like, it's a potential, well, you know what, your potential has this. Because if something is wrong with our apartments, you might try to go back and sue us. And so we can't have that problem.
In spite of the constant tumult this has brought to her life, Latasha doesn't regret her decision to take a chance on a young lawyer from Tennessee and push for change.
No different than what my forefathers did, you know, my ancestors did. As I'd be known for doing, changing the law. I mean, that would be great, though, because it would be helping a lot of people who are less fortunate.
So no one knows when the Missouri Supreme Court will come down with this decision. But regardless, we know it's going to have a big impact.
And we're going to keep watching. And if something happens, we'll be sure to let you know through the podcast, of course. But honestly, the best way to keep up and the place where we'll tell you about any development for any story we're doing this season is by following us on Facebook or Twitter. Just search for We Live Here STL.
Next time on We Live Here.
There's no political support today for desegregation programs. We've deluded ourselves into thinking that unlike the other segregations, this one was created by private practice, not by government policy, and therefore there was no constitutional requirement to undo it.
We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd.
Alana Sistrunk is our associate producer.
And Robert Peterson is our boss. He's the program director here at St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.